90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Well, Thursday at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson, along with Dave Gudnick. And today in our second segment, we will look at Trump's raising 100% tariff on China because China will be restricting rare earth and magnetic minerals. But why would China do that? There seems to be no explanation that I've been able to find, but we'll present one today. But we're going to start off with a first look at Trump is threatening to give Tomahawk missiles to the Ukraine so that these missiles could reach further into Russia. So we have Brian Berletic on the Glenn Deason program, and Brian is an international affairs analyst and former Marine, and this was posted on Monday the 13th.
News from Financial Times, not really hiding it anymore, that the Trump administration is providing the data and assisting the Zelensky with the striking Russian energy facilities deep inside Russian borders. Now, even Joe Biden, as he was looking as if he would be more inclined towards doing policies which could trigger World War III, was hesitant about doing these kind of things. I mean, it's not that many ways to interpret this. This is the U.S. engaging in acts of war, obviously against Russia. My question is just how much further the U.S. will engage in this, but also for how long it will be one-sided, because it seems to be testing Russia's patience. I just can't imagine the situation being reversed where openly in the media they're reporting on Russia assisting in deep strikes into America and doing nothing. How are you assessing this? Are these actual acts of war, or am I overreading this?
Well, I think you made a very important point there. If someone was doing this through the United States, the United States would openly accuse whichever nation was aiding and abetting such attacks of an act of war. And the U.S. has done this for far less, and even has fabricated claims in the past to justify accusing other nations of acts of war. And so this is what I think a lot of Americans and people in the West in general have a very hard time flipping the script and trying to see it from the other nation's point of view. What if they were doing this to us? How would we feel? So I think that's very important for people to do, analysts and ordinary people alike. Now, going back to first principles, we knew all along from the very beginning, from 2014 actually, long before the Russians launched their special military operation, that the United States Central Intelligence Agency went in and took over Ukrainian intelligence agencies, all of them, military, the civilian counterparts, the SBU especially, and these are the intelligence agencies implicated by the Financial Times in carrying out these deep strikes inside of Russia. So who's ultimately carrying, overseeing and carrying these out, facilitating these attacks? It was always the Central Intelligence Agency. We knew since the beginning of the special military operation that the United States military was overseeing Ukraine's armed forces and virtually everything they did, from overall strategic direction, the fighting was taking place, down to picking specific targets on the battlefield. U.S. Military commanders in operating out of Germany. This began under the Biden administration, and it continues now under the Trump administration. Both aspects, the intel and the military operations, are all being overseen by the United States. Now, you mentioned President Joe Biden and his hesitation to escalate toward this point. I think had he, let's just imagine, he ran and won a second term, he would have been doing this right now. At the time, it just wasn't ready. to move forward toward that point of escalation. But what the United States has been doing, what U.S. foreign policy in general always does, is this salami slice strategy where they are always escalating, but in such small increments that it's very hard for an adversary to point at the U.S. and say active war. They do that very specifically for that purpose. And so this is where President Trump, his administration, is. I warned about this before he even won the 2024 election. I pointed out people like his vice president nominee, J.D. Vance, saying, we're going to freeze the conflict ultimately. There was no desire for peace in Ukraine, just freezing the conflict. And at the time, J.D. Vance, this was all the way back in September, October 2024, saying, we need our weapons to go fight China, not Ukraine. We need the Europeans to take over. And then come February, once President Trump was in office, his administration was in power, U.S. Secretary of, back then, Defense, now it is the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, again, in Brussels, talking about sending in European troops to freeze the conflict, doubling down on military-industrial production, arming Ukraine, rebuilding Ukraine's military, essentially Minsk 3.0, even though he specifically said in that statement that it wasn't Minsk 3.0, but then who would believe him and just look at the things he was saying. But also, I always pointed out that he talked about Russian energy production. And at that time, he was talking about targeting it. It was very vague and ambiguous on purpose. And you might assume he was talking about price control, sanctions, tariffs, things like this. But we can see now, with our own eyes, we can see the drone strikes on Russian energy production deep inside Russia, facilitated by American intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, ISR. And so that's where we are right now. It is a steady escalation in a U.S. war on Russia, simply fought through Ukraine.
It's amazing that this, you have some of these articles come out, but there's no debate in society. I mean, we're supposed to be democracies with a free media, and yet you have these attacks on Russia. And it was kind of obvious also why there's not more debate around this, because if you criticize or skeptical about attacks, direct attacks on Russia, well, then you can be labeled as being pro-Russian. So there's no journalist who wants to keep their job would want to suggest that it's problematic. But you know, I don't want to limit my words here, but this media is just so idiotic and horrible. I mean, this is just pure garbage. You know, if you trigger a nuclear war, this is not being pro-US or Russia. We're all going to die effectively in a nuclear holocaust. I mean, imagine someone during the Cold War would criticize the idea of a surprise attack or a limited missile attack deep inside the Soviet Union. I mean, are they pro-Soviet? This is where we are as a society. But this, you mentioned this incrementalism. We do this salami tactics or incrementalism. Obviously, NATO has done this over the years as well in terms of the missile defense, expansion, well, everything. But we also do this in the media, where we now end up in a situation where, well, yeah, of course we're attacking Russia, but it's, you know, it's not a direct, it's not direct, you know, we're helping people defend them. It's just so much nonsense. But we have another problem though coming up besides this, targeting the Russian energy facilities. We also have the United States. Considering Tomahawks, which is, again, in the spirit of salami tactics, this is, one assumes that this decision has already been made, that they're just preparing the public for this future possibility, and then, of course, it will be introduced, I guess, but with some limitations. Trump doesn't want you to strike anything you want, and then, much like Biden, those limitations begin to be removed. And I don't know, this, but do you see the Tomahawks as being fundamentally different from the escalations of the past?
I think it fits in perfectly with what the United States has done. It is a major escalation, and Russia has said that it is a major escalation, although I still believe that Russia is going to try to avoid for as long as possible, even though it may be inevitable, a direct confrontation with either Europe or the United States directly. I think they want to avoid that for as long as possible. But the Tomahawk cruise missile ordinarily is launched by ships at sea, submarines. But they have been working on a ground launched version. This is the whole reason why the Trump administration left the INF treaty in the first place during his first term. And then all throughout the rest of his term and all 4 years of the Biden administration, they began developing and deploying the Typhon ground launched cruise missile system. It also fires SM-6 air defense missiles. These are naval air defense missiles. But people have been saying, well, the Typhon is very cumbersome, which they're right, and deploying it to Ukraine would be somewhat disastrous. It would severely limit what Ukraine could do with these missiles. It's likely that Russia would find them sooner rather than later and destroy these launchers. But as I pointed out recently, there was another ground-launched system. It was the long-range fires developed by Lockheed Martin to fire the Tomahawk, which is a Raytheon missile. It's much smaller and more mobile. It's a single cell. There's these Mark 41 vertical launch systems that the Tomahawk is launched from. It has a single cell, while the Typhon has four cells. And what this would enable Ukraine to do is they would have a few of these, and the U.S. did have working prototypes of this. The U.S. Marine Corps was testing them out. They ultimately passed on this system, but they exist. U.S. Army has been considering adopting it and using it to complement the Typhon missile launcher. And so if the U.S. does send Tomahawks to Ukraine, I would say this is the most likely candidate. It's a more mobile, easier to hide system. And of course, obviously, the U.S. would be doing everything except possibly, but maybe also pushing the button to fire these. Again, almost everything Ukraine is doing is simply the U.S. fighting Russia through Ukrainian proxies, and the deployment of Tomahawks would be no exception. As people have pointed out, Russian air defenses would be able to defend against this. They would probably be using these to strike oil production, energy production facilities deep inside Russia. They would try to avoid targets that are more heavily defended by Russian air defense systems. They wouldn't be able to deploy many of these because, again, what the United States is doing is tying Russia down in Ukraine. They want to deploy their resources, focus their resources on China. So they would be deploying, a relatively small number of these missiles, which are not made in large quantities, not even 100 a year compared to Russian counterparts, which are hundreds, sometimes 1,000 or more every year. So this is what we're looking at. It is an escalation. It's not going to change the trajectory of the conflict, but it will raise the cost for Russia. It will tie Russia down more and raise the cost for Russia. People have to remember, U.S. doesn't care about Ukraine. This isn't about Ukraine winning. In 2019, the RAND Corporation said that if you provoke a war with Russia in Ukraine, Ukraine's probably going to be completely destroyed. So this is not why they're fighting. They're fighting to raise the cost as much as possible for Russia, and deploying Tomahawk missiles contributes toward that objective.
Specific that the benefit of raising the temperature and having more direct fights is, of course, can bleed and drain the Russians. The disadvantage is if Russia begins to win and take strategic territory, then the strategic shift will be in Russia's advantage. So as long as you can keep the war static and have the Ukrainians and Russians kill each other, then it's a win. Once major territories begin to shift to Russia, giving it strategic advantage against the United States, then it becomes a bad war.
So that was Brian Berletic on the Glenn Deason Show, War on Russia and Pending Retaliation. And Dave Gudnick, you have, in fact, you write about this in your Southside Pride articles often enough. And this month, there's somebody wrote in complaining there's concern about Russophobia article, and you have a reply. But why don't you talk about some of this stuff about how you see this Russophobia?
Okay, thanks, Don. One of the first things I want to mention, highlighting what Brian Berletic was discussing, is that the U.S. basically since 2014 when we began rebuilding from the ground up the intelligence and the military forces and the strategy and the reconnaissance intelligence surveillance activities in Ukraine. So despite official pretense that it's a Ukraine war, it's a U.S. war, and this has actually come out in, you know, much more detail in the New York Times, official mouthpiece of the establishment, and in a lot of other places. So again, documenting and explaining that it's a U.S. war, it's a pretense to say it's Ukraine's war. And they actually gave up their agency to address a concern of some people, both radical types and others, defending Ukraine agency. Well, they basically, in my opinion, gave up their agency in 2014 when they allowed a right-wing coup and then allowed the United States to basically take over, you know, the executive functions of their country. And unfortunately, they're being denied agency now, and it's quite difficult circumstances. So that's one thing to say. And also on to Glenn Deason, whose platform that was on. Yeah, there's a high level of propaganda and denial of criticism, and it's just important to realize that, and you have to seek out some of these alternative sources. So Brian Berletic and Glenn Deason are great examples of that. A couple more points just to reinforce that Ukraine is a means for war on Russia and has been since, you know, some number of years prior to 2014, actually. Retired General Ben Hodges, another warmonger, was recently quoted as saying explicitly, Ukraine war is a means for U.S. war on Russia. So I've been trying to write some of these columns to explain, and the Russophobia thing was just a little more background history than usual, and most of it, it's focused on how for the past 10, 20, 30 years, really back to the 90s, the U.S. has planned and provoked this war. And so planned and provoked by the U.S., and whenever you hear unprovoked, it's a lie, and whenever you hear full-scale invasion, that's also a lie. Do you know that the Ukraine army was probably several times, maybe as much as five times the size of the invading Russian force, because Russia wasn't planning for a full-scale invasion, and that's not how it played out. We've explored some of this history and in the betrayed agreements that followed from that.
Yes, it was near unanimous throughout the media on not going into this before all this developed, the special operations or invasion of Ukraine. But every, you know, National Public Radio, public PBS News Hour, and the BBC, they all had people talking about the history leading up to it. Well, they stopped before the U.S. coup in 2014, over 2013-2014 in Kiev. And so they put in, right, facilitated by the United States. And it's, and since then, they began a, hundreds of times I heard, unprovoked, 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 unprovoked. So it was hard.
It's a classic case of projection because we provoked, wanting Russia to be drawn in and eventually in defense of the Russian-speaking, Russian-identified populations in East Ukraine, they were drawn in by those republics which had declared their independence because of being persecuted and bombarded by the forces out of Ukraine, out of Kiev.
And so they, there was attacks on these areas by Zelensky and the regime, and they were trying to abolish Russia as an official language, even though it's many people spoke both Ukraine and Russian. But the people who were Russian speakers, especially in this Donbass area and right next to Russia, they spoke Russian. They identified with Russia, and they were attacked over many years, and I think it was something like 14,000 casualties.
And this began immediately after the 2014 coup, one of the very first acts of the post-coup parliament was to recognize all the official languages that were allowed for transactions, except they excluded Russian, which actually happened to be the majority language. So that was just the beginning of the discrimination and bombardment, and also a discrimination against the Russian Eastern Orthodox Church, which is extremely important to the population. Russia, by the way, to remind listeners, is the largest Christian nation that is identified as such in the world. I want to go back to a couple other things that Brian's talking about, the weaponry business. And first of all, there's a long, relatively long, a few years history of the U.S. prolonging this because they want to prolong the war. They want to weaken Russia. They want to drag this on. Ukraine is a sacrifice. They're willing to fight to the last Ukrainian. And they keep coming up with the latest wonder weapon, which is really going to turn the tide. And they need to turn the tide because, in general, things have not been going well at all for Ukraine, despite a couple counteroffensives, and they're looking worse and worse and worse. And so now they're trying to pretend it's a stalemate, but it's not. It's worse than that, and I think we're going to find out in the coming weeks and months it's not at all a stalemate. But one tactic has been to promise just another weapon, the Abrams tanks, the Javelin missiles, the ATACMS missiles, the F-16s, and now it's the Tomahawks. But information I have, as Brian indicated, it's probably not going to make much difference. For one, they don't have a lot of them to spare. Also, it is mostly old, a little updated, and is not necessarily available with nuclear capacity. So there's a lot of ambiguity, and some are calling it Tomahawks. But this is, again, just the tactic that's being used to escalate, even though these increased military elements have not so far really made a difference. And Ukraine is losing this war, and it's looking bad. And one more point is that Brian and others have been helpful in pointing out that the U.S. strategy is strategic sequencing. In other words, the confrontation is at its hottest, not always in the same place, and they try to pursue other confrontations. Again, overall strategies attacking Russia, whether that's in the Baltics, Kaliningrad, Ukraine, in the Caucasus, to mess up the transit corridors and relations with Iran, and so on and so on. And so there's a lot of places where you need to know that the overall strategy, and has been for many years, over 100 years in my opinion, is war on Russia.
And you were telling me about, you had seen some quotes from the head of NATO, Rutte.
Oh, yeah. There's a couple of outstanding examples of the delusory, deceptive comments going on by the pro-war speakers and officials. One is from Mark Rutte, head of NATO, and the other one is from Andrew Rifkin, a U.S. journalist. I'm going to say something about both of those. Now, Rutte must have been like lacking sleep or something because he really went overboard, even though it was a sympathetic audience. Maybe that was what helped him to go overboard, but he was talking about how Russia is losing, the NATO military is far superior to Russia, 25 times, infinitely stronger. These are what he was saying. And in Ukraine, totally false. He says Russia does not have air superiority, which is just crazy, contradicting what most everyone knows. You can't even fly out of Kiev. You got to take the train because the air superiority is so much on Russian sides that it's not safe. So anyway, really delusory. This is a man who's supposed to be ahead of NATO military, but he's just, you know, reciting the lines that somebody prompted him or coached him to say, as I see it. And then Andrew Rifkin is a warmongering, allegedly liberal in The Atlantic. I've seen his name in The New York Times as well. And he's got in the current Atlantic, to me, outrageously misguided analysis about how Russia is losing, the Russian economy is cooling, things are just going our way, just hang on, you know, just keep going. That's the whole message. The message, whether stated explicitly or not, is let's keep this war going and try to weaken Russia. As far as its economy, you know, inflation is down from before. It's still got a strong growth rate. It's doing way better than the U.S., for example, where the debt-to-GDP ratio is 120%. Over in Russia, it's only 20% debt-to-GDP. And if you measure by purchasing power parity, not GDP, but a more comparable, more fair standard for comparing country-to-country economies, purchasing power parity, look it up if you need to. The Russian economy has now exceeded Japan and Germany to become number four in the world after China, U.S., and India. So this is totally false stuff coming from Andrew Rifkin, a supposedly intelligent and liberal journalist in the current Atlantic, and it's real typical of the propaganda that's out there.
And it's so interesting how NATO, which includes most of the European Union countries, has been privy to this whole buildup since the 1990s of making Russia into an enemy. When Russia came out of the demise of the Soviet Union, and there wasn't supposed to be a NATO 1 foot to the east, well, under Bill Clinton, they added three former countries that were right next to Russia, the Poland, Romania, and Czech. And they, they've gradually added more and more. And over the years, Putin was appointed in the year around 2000, and he began warning the West, warning people in NATO, don't make us an enemy. Don't make us an enemy. But so they have all along been part of this plan that the U.S. has brought about to take down Russia. And as you've talked about, what do they want in Russia? They want minerals. They want resources.
World's number one commodity producer and one or two in commodity exporter.
So this, you have to understand a lot of this stuff where you might think, well, surely Europe must be okay.
The European leadership has been suborned, allowed itself to be suborned by the U.S., incredible power, financial and other. This does not necessarily reflect the popular opinion at all. In fact, their current leadership is extremely unpopular over there in the main European countries. But, you know, part two of the strategy of long-term strategy of war on Russia, and I mean a century long, part two is, more recently somewhat, prevent European dependence on Russia. Integration of economic, basically energy, which is key to all economic activities. This is why the Nord Stream pipeline was blown up, and they've been thinking and strategizing against this gas pipeline connection since the 1980s. And they have succeeded in through sanctions as well in greatly weakening the European economies and the leadership being suborned to the United States through various means has allowed this to go on. And now several of these countries' economies are in very bad shape, Germany the foremost.
Yes. They were the ones that most depended upon the cheap U.S. oil, Russian oil and gas. And when President Biden said it'll never operate, it'll never operate, he said that publicly. And lo and behold, it was blown up. And
Yeah, and I like how to remind people of, I've brought this up before, that Sikorsky, defense minister, also had been a foreign minister, an interior minister, and a bunch of top positions in Poland, and a warmonger for sure in this issue. The day of the Nord Stream pipeline blew up, he posted on social media a color picture with the blue Baltic Sea with this enormous methane bubble coming up, an environmental disaster. And one line underneath, it says, "Thank you, USA."
Well, at least he knew.
Now they're making up stories now. It was a bunch of Ukrainians, and, you know, they're going and round about Germany and Poland, and they're pointing fingers, and Poland's got one of the accused, and they're not returning them.
Somebody,
it's all a big distraction.
Somebody in a yacht went and did this, but it was technically sophisticated to be able to do this. Now let's go to our second part of it. Pasco Natas will be talking about China's rare earth and magnetic restriction that's threatening the U.S. Defense Department supply chain. He was on his own democracy studies, which he dedicates to peace.
Neutrality studies. It's an excellent site. He's from the formerly neutral zone of Switzerland and Austria. Now he lives in Japan, but really excellent. He's professorial in some respects, but he has great interviews on international matters. Neutrality studies, Pascal Natas.
And so this is from posted on Monday also.
Imagine for 1 second that you spent the last 3 years throwing your weapons stockpile at the Russians in a proxy war in Ukraine, either by doing so directly, giving the Ukrainians your weapons, or by using NATO to give them your weapons, or use the Europeans who buy weapons from you and then give them to the Europeans and throw them at the Russians. You love this because your military industrial complex makes tons and tons of money. And even better, you can empty out your stockpile even more by funding the Israelis to the tune of $22 billion, who then use the weapons to genocide the population in Gaza. And you are even looking at the prospect of more such interventions against Iran and others. And that is a fantastic business. But then you suddenly realize that, we have a production capacity problem. We're actually running low on weapons. And in that moment, when you actually decide that, it's time now to rebuild our weapons, somebody steps in and says, not so fast. Well, that's what happened right now on what the Chinese did last week. And this is why the United States is actually, for the first time, seriously, seriously angry at the Chinese, not just faking it. So in the media, what we read last week is actually a bit of an exercise of gaslighting. And even on social media, some people are not catching on to what the real story is. Now, what we are being told of what happened last week is that the Chinese escalated the trade war, right? And this is, for instance, how the Wall Street Journal frames it, and we need to unpack this a little bit, because the real story is actually about the US capacity to wage war. But the official story to the front is that China's just being mean in the trade war, right? And the Wall Street Journal writes that China's rare earth escalation threatens trade talks and the global economy. President Trump says Washington is weighing responses. So this was just till last week. And by now we know that Trump is threatening a 100% tariff on all Chinese goods that come into the United States. And Trump was obviously and visibly very irritated at what China did here. Now, actually, all over the place, in CNN, BBC, and so on, this problem is being framed as a problem of, the trade war getting worse.
But if you look at what's actually going on under the hood, you start realizing, as actually a couple of think tanks did, that no, it's not that China is trying to gain the upper hand in trade. China is trying to make it harder for the United States to produce weaponry, to make these implements of war, as they are called. There's this very good paper by the Center for Security, the CSIS, China's new rare earth magnet restrictions threaten U.S. defense supply chains. And this is the real story, not the trade tensions. The fact that now, for the first time, somebody in the global economy did something that is going to make it seriously even harder for the United States to produce weaponry. Because you must understand that the U.S. this year understood itself that it has a production capacity a supply problem, that it cannot produce enough weaponry. We know now that the United States, NATO itself, has been running out of just normal shells that they used in Ukraine. The Ukrainians cannot be supplied at an adequate level in order to fight the Russians. This actually scared quite a lot of people in the US, and they said we need to do something immediately to reverse this. And the Chinese are now making that much, much harder. So let's look first at what are actually the new regulations that the Chinese put out, and then also how the Chinese, of course, frame this entire situation. Now, the CSIS report is actually quite good, because it focuses on the technical details. What you need to understand about these, about the trade restrictions that are coming from China, is that they are a very normal tool, a tool that the United States has been using a lot in the past. Let me just read you a bit from this article. The new export controls mark the first time China has applied the Foreign Direct Product Rule, FDPR, a mechanism introduced in 1959 and long used by Washington to restrict semiconductor exports to China. So what Beijing now does is it is applying this rule, which it says is a norm because the United States is using it for a long time, in order to regulate what other countries can produce with something that is sourced in China. Let's just continue on to understand really what kind of trade restriction China is imposing. The new licensing framework will apply to foreign-produced rare earth magnets and select semiconductor materials that contain at least 0.1% heavy rare earth elements sourced from China. Given China's dominance in the sector, according to roughly 70% of rare earth mining, 90% of separation and processing, and 93% of magnet manufacturing, these developments will have major national security implications. And the CSIS is right on the money. The problem the United States has is not that China somehow globally now restricts its rare earth exports and is going to make it harder for the US economy to flourish. China officially is now making it very difficult for the United States to replenish its arms stockpile. And this is well understood, by the way. The US understands this, and because China tells them so. Just let me show you for one moment how the Chinese are actually introducing these measures. And you will understand that it's not about trade in general. It's really about the capacity to make weapons. China officially targets this. So this is the Chinese announcement that they put out on Thursday last week, on the 9th of October. And I just ran this through my translation software. And I'm just going to read out this to you. This is what the Chinese officially said in front of the cameras, in front of Chinese media, of what these new rules are about. And they clearly say that they imply export control of dual-use items. It's even in the title of the law that the Chinese are referencing that they're now going to make stricter. Let me just read to you from here. This is what the Chinese are saying. Rare earth-related items have a dual-use characteristics, both civilian and military. Implementing export controls on such items is a common international practice. In April of this year, the Chinese government imposed export controls on the export of rare earth items by Chinese organizations and individuals. Related rare earth technologies have also been listed in the catalog of technologies prohibited or restricted from export by China since as early as 2001. The Chinese are telling us here they have had export controls for over 20 years. This is nothing new under the sun. This is just an increase of the controls. So far, so good. However, for some time, certain foreign organizations and individuals have directly or indirectly transferred or provided Chinese origin-controlled rare earth items, either in raw or processed form, to entities and individuals involved in military or other sensitive fields. These actions have caused serious harm or potential threats to China's national security and interests, undermined international peace and stability, and damaged global non-proliferation efforts. Therefore, the Chinese government has decided in accordance with the law to implement export controls on certain overseas rare earth-related items containing Chinese components. The goal is to better safeguard national security and interests and to more effectively fulfill China's international obligations in non-proliferation-related areas. As a responsible major power, China's decision to implement such controls reflects its consistent stance of firmly upholding world peace and regional stability and actively participating in international non-proliferation efforts. China is willing to strengthen communication, yada, yada, yada. One more thing, it should be noted that these scope of items covered by these controls is limited and various facilitation measures will be introduced for licensing procedures. The Chinese government will grant licenses for exports that comply with relevant regulations, export for humanitarian purposes, such as urgent medical needs, response to public health emergencies, and disaster relief, will be exempt from licensing requirements in addition to accommodate stakeholders' needs to fulfill existing commercial contracts and comply with regulations as a reasonable transition period has been established. So the chance that clearly what this is curbing of other states' ability to use Chinese rare earths for their weapons production purposes. So the Chinese are now restricting rare earths to be used for these for dual-use goods and for military goods straight out. If you want to use Chinese rare earths to create weapons, then, well, the Chinese are just not going to sell it to you. China is now going to forbid its companies from selling these materials or selling goods that contain components and materials, and this is why it's a licensing issue. It's going to make sure that if you want to use rare earth materials, let's say to make an iPhone or something, you need to promise that these goods then will not be used for military application. And you need to, the Chinese will obviously then try to implement a mechanism to check on whether that's the case or not. So really, China is now cracking down and using its major capacity, its monopoly in rare earths, to try to impede other states' ability to make weapons out of these components.
Now you are.
Yeah, I want to point out several things for context that Pascal Lattès is referring to there. One, he mentions right at the beginning that the military-industrial, needless to say, has a very strong profit motive. They want things to grow and to continue and to expand in their realm. And so this is a very powerful force. Could never be overlooked in what determines U.S. policy and strategy. Secondly, for context, although he doesn't say it explicitly, I think he might later on, but it's clear, and the U.S. is fighting this, the China economy is stronger. The world has changed, and despite our pretenses and our enormous debt bubbles, which are in danger of deflating, China has a stronger economy. And, you know, there's a parallel. We're desperate for escalation in Ukraine, as we talked about just a bit ago, and I think we're desperate for some kind of move against China because of the crisis that's been brought to the fore by these restrictions. Now, about those restrictions, context there is that the U.S. knew about this issue 20-some years ago, but we exported the dirty part, which is mining and processing of minerals. China said, oh, we'll do it. And now they have 80, 90% of the world's mining and processing of these extremely important minerals. They're not just dual-use military. Of course, that's the focus of the dispute. But they're also used in magnetic MRI medical and in computer chips and semiconductors and a lot of uses. Now, of course, a lot of dual use as well. And China has finally felt it was in a position to restrict this, and it's going to have enormous impact on the U.S. economy. And I think if you in the next segment, he's getting into why they might be strategically ready. China might be, that is, because the key thing that they weren't quite up to production, now they're over 50%, is helium. And the U.S. had a big stake in that, and now China has made big advances in that as well and would not be subject to U.S. pressure nearly as much as formerly on the matter of helium, which is another very essential element in modern technology and production.
Helium is well-regarded. There's been some noise about maybe a helium might be sourced in northern Minnesota. But Trump is taking this power that should be in Congress about tariffs and doing this or this or that. And we'll be talking about the no kings, no dictators this Saturday having a march. But it's China has said, well, the U.S. is going to be this way, so they've been changing their trade orientation. And even though a lot of it to the U.S. has been cut down, supposedly they've had an 8% increase in their exports. And so it's there's much of the world out there, whereas the U.S. is really starting, I think, to suffer from problems of access that the Trump's desire to have manufacturing in the U.S., well, actually, that sector is going down. And these things don't just, with a snap of the fingers, change. And it takes years for investment, for supply chain, and et cetera. And so it's kind of funny that Trump is going to be sending $20 billion to Argentina for this guy who with a chainsaw caught a lot of headlines in this country with Elon Musk when they were cutting things down. But the U.S. is really, I notice it going around town, there's a loss of, there's not enough people around here for businesses that want to have things because of this attack by the on immigrants. People have never done anything. Not the worst of the worst. That's just foo-foo. But it's really starting to affect things, and it's going to get worse.
That and the tariffs are still inducing damage. That's unfolding. I think we haven't seen the worst at all in terms of the tariff impact, and the immigration is starting to become evident of the interference with that. Just a couple more points about the compare to the world's two biggest economies and why I'm insisting that the China economy is stronger. Once again, we're overloaded with debt, and that's going to cause some big problems, perhaps in the near future, and many people are predicting that. But also in terms of these threats of massive tariffs coming from both sides, they're going to have to resolve this. Now, China does not depend strongly on exports to the U.S., So whatever we threaten is only going to be a minor part of their export activity, which, of course, is the biggest in the world, the biggest exporter in the world, and not that much of it goes to the U.S., you know, some like 15% or something. And also U.S. exports to China aren't that big for our exports. And so the leverage is minimal here, and I think our people are desperate, and they're going to have to come to some kind of compromise before the threatened level of restrictions by China take hold, because these dual use or not, these critical minerals really are critical.
Yes. What did you do when your country was well on the way to becoming a police state run by an autocrat for himself and his billionaire friends who do not respect citizens, democracy, and the rule of law? Answer: one thing I did was show up for the biggest protest in American history. So this Saturday, the No Kings, No Dictators are having a here in metropolitan area, at least five or six different places you can go to. This at the Commons, downtown Minneapolis, 425 Portland. That's this grassy area just towards downtown from the football stadium. That's at from 1 o'clock, the march through downtown at 2 o'clock. And there's one from Penn and 66th in Richfield, Golden Valley, Chaska, Burnsville. So you can go to nokings.org for more locations and to sign up. And this is backed by a whole plethora of different groups. I think I might have time for Caitlin Johnstone to give one of her
rants.
And she analyzed Trump's talk to the Israeli Knesset this last Monday.
His first term.
Yes.
Trump keeps admitting that he's bought and owned by the world's richest Israeli. It's bizarre how little mainstream attention is given to the fact that the President of the United States has repeatedly confessed to being bought and owned by the world's richest Israeli, especially given how intensely fixated his political opposition was on the possibility that he was compromised by a foreign government during his first term. During a speech before the Israeli parliament on Monday, President Trump once again publicly admitted that he has implemented Israel-friendly policies at the behest of Israeli-American billionaire Miriam Adelson and her late husband Sheldon, this time adding that he believes Adelson favors Israel over the United States. Here's a transcript of Trump's remarks. As president, I terminated the disastrous Iran nuclear deal, and ultimately I terminated Iran's nuclear program with things called B-2 bombers. It was swift and it was accurate and it was a military beauty. I authorized the spending of billions of dollars which went to Israel's defense, as you know. And after years of broken promises from many other American presidents, you know that they kept promising, I never understood it until I got there. There was a lot of pressure put on these presidents. It was put on me, too, but I didn't yield to the pressure. But every president for decades said, we're going to do it. The difference is I kept my promise and officially recognized the capital of Israel and moved the American embassy to Jerusalem. Isn't that right, Miriam? Look at Miriam. She's back there. Stand up. Miriam and Sheldon Adelson would come into the office and call me. They'd call me. I think they had more trips to the White House than anybody else, I guess. Look at her sitting there so innocently. Got $60 billion in the bank. $60 billion. And she loves. And she, I think she said, no more. She loves Israel, but she loves it. And they would come in, and her husband was a very aggressive man, but I loved him. He was very aggressive, very supportive of me. And he'd call up, can I come over and see you? And I'd say, Sheldon, I'm the President of the United States. It doesn't work that way. He'd come in. But they were very responsible for so much, including getting me thinking about Golan Heights, which is probably one of the greatest things that ever happened. Miriam, stand up, please. She really is. I mean, she loves this country. She loves this country.
Her and her husband are so incredible. We miss him so dearly. But I actually asked her, I'm going to get her in trouble with this, but I actually asked her once, I said, so Miriam, I know you love Israel. What do you love more, the United States or Israel? She refused to answer. That might mean Israel, I must say. We love you. Thank you, darling, for being here. That's a great honor. Great honor. She's a wonderful woman. She's a great woman. End quote. Sheldon Adelson reportedly gave Trump and the Republicans over $424 million in campaign funding from 2016 up until his death in 2021. His widow, Miriam, continued her husband's legacy and poured a further $100 million into Trump's 2024 presidential campaign. On the 2024 campaign trail, Trump also admitted to being controlled by Adelson cash. Here's a transcript of those remarks. Just as I promised, I recognized Israel's eternal capital and opened the American embassy in Jerusalem. Jerusalem became the capital. I also recognized Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. You know, Miriam and Sheldon would come into the White House probably almost more than anybody outside of people who worked there. And they were always after, as soon as I'd give them something, always for Israel. As soon as I'd give them something, they'd want something else. I'd say, give me a couple of weeks, will you please? But I gave them the Golan Heights. They never even asked for it. You know, for 72 years they've been trying to do the Golan Heights, right? And even Sheldon didn't have the nerve. But I said, you know what? I said to David Friedman, give me a quick lesson, like 5 minutes or less on the Golan Heights. And he did. And I said, let's do it. We got it done in about 15 minutes, right? End quote. Legitimizing Israel's illegal annexation of the Golan Heights and moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem were two of the most controversial moves Trump made in Israel's favor during his first term, which have now been eclipsed by his backing the genocide in Gaza and his bombings of Iran and Yemen. And here he is, openly admitting that his billionaire Zionist mega-donors have been using the access their donations bought them to push him to take drastic action in favor of Israel. Just imagine for a second if someone had leaked documents to the press proving that Trump had received extensive financial backing from a Russian oligarch to whom he doled out political favors of immense geopolitical consequence. It would be the biggest scandal in the history of American politics, bar none. But because it's an Israeli oligarch, he can admit it openly and repeatedly without anyone batting an eye. During Trump's first term, his political rivals spent years pushing a bogus conspiracy theory that he was controlled by Vladimir Putin, despite his having spent that entire term aggressively ramping up Cold War hostilities against Russia. Entire political punditry careers were birthed trying to create a scandal out of a narrative that could be plainly seen as false just by looking at the movements of the U.S. war machine and Washington's actions against Moscow. But here's Trump openly admitting to bending over backwards to give an Israeli oligarch whatever she wants because she gave his campaign huge sums of money while pouring weapons into Israel to facilitate its mass atrocities and engaging in acts of war on Israel's behalf. And it barely makes a blip in mainstream Western politics or media. This is because mainstream Western politics and media understand that we are living in an unofficial oligarchic empire to which both the U.S. and Israel belong. They never acknowledge it, they never talk about it, but all high-level politicians, pundits, and operatives in the Western world understand that they serve a globe-spanning power structure run by a loose alliance of plutocrats and empire managers. They understand that states like Israel are a part of said power structure, while states like Russia, China, and Iran are not. So they spend their time normalizing the corruption and abuses of imperial member states, while facilitating the empire's efforts to attack and undermine the states that have successfully resisted being absorbed into the imperial power umbrella. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. The only thing I like about Donald Trump is his infantile tendency to say the quiet part out loud. He advances the same kinds of abuses as his predecessors, who were no less corrupt and controlled, but he exposes the underlying mechanics of those abuses in ways that more refined presidents never would.
So that was Diana Johnstone. This has been the Northern Sun Radio News Show today, with John Olson and Dave Gudnick.
Caitlin Johnston.
That was Caitlin Johnston.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
1934 was a bad year. The Great Depression was as great as they said it was. Even gangsters had it hard. FDR had legalized booze, so there went the lucrative bootlegging biz. But Alvin Creepy Karpis had found a new line, kidnapping. January 7th, 1934, Karpis and his gang were at it again, scooping up the heir of two St. Paul, Minnesota dynasties, banking and beer, Edward Bremer. Bremer didn't give up easily, but after a little knocking about, they stashed him in the car and sped him off to their safe house. Only getting ransom out of this well-heeled banker proved somewhat disagreeable. Bremer was cranky and unhelpful, except when ratting out the other St. Paul grandees, who, he said, made much better captives. And his dad balked at paying such a hefty ransom for his offspring. He did, though, and Ed Bremer was released back to his mansion and inherited wealth, while Karpis and his gang paid for their money-making scheme behind bars.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online.